Angeles parking ticket. 2.5 weeks of groceries, 2 days of rent in the average LA apartment, eating out with your friends 6 times, 2 months of utilities, doing your laundry 30 times, a one-way plane ticket, 1 month's internet bill, almost 2 months of gym membership.
One Angelino venting about how expensive LA parking tickets are in a YouTube video. In related news, this Sunday is Easter, a day of chocolate, jelly beans, sunshine, and expensive parking. It's one of the busiest days of the year for public parks, and in Orange County, parks officials have decided to charge higher parking rates on the holiday. Well, here in LA, a similar move. This week, Mayor Eric Garcetti released his first budget, and part of his plan to bring in more revenue is to issue more parking tickets. Stephen Vincent is founder of the Los Angeles Parking Freedom Initiative. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you, Madeline. Thanks for having me.
Well, what is the Parking Freedom Initiative?
Well, basically back in about November, I threw together some ideas that I had about reforming the parking system and took them to my local neighborhood council. And I wasn't expecting to really get much of a response, but in fact, I was mobbed after the meeting by people encouraging me to continue. And I continued to take my ideas out to neighborhood councils and chambers of commerce, stakeholders, organizations, and continued to get a lot of encouragement and a lot of ideas. We've collated those ideas, and we're in the process of narrowing them down into a package of reforms that we plan on putting on a ballot initiative for March 2015 citywide election.
So I assume you're not in favor of the mayor's plan to issue more parking tickets as a way to bring in more money for the city.
Well, that was actually a major disappointment because we've had conversations with the mayor's office, and we were really optimistic that they were able to see the wisdom of a shift in policy. In fact, you know, now we're getting more of the same, and we're quite disappointed with that. Revenue-driven parking enforcement, it needs to end. There needs to be an end to the budgetary practice of parking violations revenue targeting.
Well, the city does need to raise money, doesn't it?
The city does need to raise money, but parking is a service that the city needs to provide, not a means to an end. It's a service in and of itself that ought to facilitate commerce, ease of transit, and livability for the residents and businesses of the city.
Right. Well, here's a devil's advocate question. Doesn't more or higher parking fees actually help in terms of encouraging people to use public transit?
I don't personally believe that the parking system and parking fines or fees should be used as a club to bludgeon people into changing their behavior. There are other ways of getting people to change their behavior through persuasiveness and through making the other options really good. If the other options were really good, then people would make better choices.
So what is the price now? What is the average price of a ticket?
Well, the lowest ticket is $58 right now, and an expired parking meter is $63. When you look at it in these terms, the average, a person who's making at or near minimum wage basically is robbed of an entire day's work for one of those tickets. And that we don't feel that that meets a standard of reasonableness or fairness. We're proposing that a good standard might be the Bureau of Labor Statistics average hourly wage for the city, which comes in around $24 and change. And that might make a good cap for parking tickets that don't involve any kind of hazard to the public or don't involve handicap parking.
So $24 as the highest amount?
Yeah, that would be a proposed cap based on the average hourly wage. That 1 hour's worth of work for the average person would be sufficient incentive to get them to comply with the parking law. And I think that's reasonable. I think that would incentivize people sufficiently. The problem is that the city asks the question not what is necessary to incentivize people to comply with the law, but basically how much can we get away with? They look at their domain over the parking system essentially like a monopoly capitalist. How much will the market bear? How much can we get away with? That's the wrong question for a city government to be asking. They should be asking the question rather, what is necessary in order to gain compliance?
Well, and is there a law of diminishing returns in effect? If parking tickets are so high, people just won't pay them.
There is that factor as well, and it's not just a question of not wanting to pay them. It's also a question of being able to pay them. You know, for a lot of people who are basically paycheck to paycheck and getting by, they get that big $63 or $78 ticket. It goes in a drawer. They forget about it. And then several weeks later, that doubles. They look at it again after they get the notice in the mail, and they look at the decision of whether they're going to feed their kids or pay that ticket, and guess what they're going to choose? Feed the kids or pay the electric bill or whatever it happens to be. And that decision gets postponed until it becomes an even bigger disaster eventually, you know, meaning that they cannot, you know, re-register their car at the DMV. And then that's going to result in even larger problems. And this is a very common thing. And if people are being forced to the wall in that way through something as simple as getting back to the meter a couple of minutes late, there's something wrong with the system, not something wrong with the people.
Where does LA fit in regards to other cities? Are we an outlier in terms of how much we charge for parking?
On the high end, not the highest, I believe, from what I understand, but we are on the high end. And it's not merely the size of the fines. It's the practices. That's what I want to focus on today. It's the budgetary practice of parking violations revenue targeting that is quite possibly the primary driving factor here, because what happens is the parking enforcement division basically gets a bill from the city that says, we expect you to collect this amount of money. That becomes a de facto target that they have to go out there and collect. And that basically changes the dynamics of the parking enforcement in incentivizing them to be very aggressive about issuing tickets. And essentially, there's a, you know, basically ticket them all and let God sort them out type of an approach out there, particularly when that's coupled with the fact that the Parking Violations Bureau routinely denies all appeals on the first go round, because they know the vast majority of people simply do not have the time or the inclination to take it to the level of a hearing. Mm-hmm. And so they drop it, and therefore they either end up paying it or it ends up going on their DMV, causing them a great deal of grief later on.
Okay. So, we're going to have to end it there, unfortunately. A lot more to talk about. Stephen Vincent, founder of the Los Angeles Parking Freedom Initiative. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And if you do have thoughts on this, some ideas, I kind of think you might, you can leave us a voicemail at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can leave a comment on our Facebook page, KCRW's Press Play. Let's talk about another way you might lose your hard-earned money, wage theft. That's when employers find ways to keep wages they should be paying their employees. And there are several class action lawsuits filed against big companies like McDonald's over this. Catherine Rampell wrote about wage theft for The Washington Post, and she's here now. Welcome.
Good to be here.
Well, tell us some ways that this happens, this wage theft.
Well, if you want to think about low-wage employees, a lot of the times this happens because employers are just outright not paying minimum wage, so that's one way. But they could be doing sort of sneakier things like working workers off the clock, claiming that workers have taken breaks that they haven't taken, and so shaving time off of their time cards.
Yeah, you wrote about that in one case in Memphis, right, at a McDonald's
right,
in Memphis?
Right, it's very common, actually. There are other things that require a bit more of a sleight of hand, like moving the workers' hours once they're about to hit overtime into the next pay period, so that therefore they're not paid at the overtime rate, when they're legally required to be paid time and a half. If you say, well, actually, the 41st hour that you worked this week, we're going to shift into next week's paycheck, then therefore we don't have to pay you the higher rate. So there are a lot of different ways that this happens.
And how often do workers actually know this is happening?
That's a very difficult question. The workers who are most vulnerable to this tend to be lower wage workers who don't know their rights, whose paychecks may be sort of cloaked in somewhat of secrecy. They don't actually see the final time card that their check is based on, that sort of thing. So I think a lot of the time workers don't know. They may have a suspicion, but it's very hard for them to gather evidence. unless they've been keeping, you know, their own set of notes about what their hours are, for example. But frequently, workers are not aware of this, and even if they are aware of it, they don't necessarily know what their rights are, and that if they complain, if they file a complaint with the Department of Labor, for example, that, you know, these are federal crimes, and that their employers could actually get in a lot of trouble, although in practice they don't often.
And do the employers' parent companies know that this is happening? These things are happening at franchises mainly, right?
Franchises have certainly been the target of a lot of lawsuits. We've seen it at McDonald's in a lot of places, but also Domino's, other fast food restaurants, retail stores. You know, it's very tricky. Usually, from what I understand, the franchise agreement will say something along the lines of, we are not a co-employer, you know, which is what legally you have to be in order to be held liable for these kinds of wage and hourly violations. And, you know, we are telling you to abide by the law, and you have to abide by the law, and if you don't, it's your own problem. You know, we are not liable. These lawsuits that you mentioned before that have come on the scene in the last month against McDonald's are a bit unusual in that they have targeted not only the franchisees but McDonald's corporate, because the plaintiffs say that McDonald's monitors its franchisees so closely, you know, requiring them to install these proprietary computer systems that basically say by the hour how much money each location is spending on labor costs, that there's no way that McDonald's didn't know that some of its franchise partners were basically engaging in shady practices. And the plaintiffs also claim that McDonald's may have even encouraged the bad behavior by constantly pressuring its franchisees to cut labor costs. That basically there are only so many ways you can legally cut labor costs before you end up in these, you know, sort of wage theft territories. But the cases have not gone to court yet, so we don't actually know, you know, what the courts will decide.
Well, what do the defendants say in this? Do they have a plausible reason for doing these kinds of things?
Well, in the McDonald's suit specifically, I asked to speak with McDonald's representatives, and they just sent me this sort of boilerplate statement that they've been sending to a lot of media outlets, basically saying, we're looking into the allegations, we're investigating our, you know, internally, and we will take action where it's appropriate. Obviously, if an employer, whether it's a franchisee or a corporate, is never going to say that they are doing this deliberately. And if this kind of wage theft is discovered, my guess is that it's usually scapegoated on, you know, some manager who didn't abide by the law, or it was a mistake or whatever. But the issue is that even when violations are found to occur, you know, when the Department of Labor says, you know, we're imposing penalties for these kinds of actions, you know, basically stealing wages from workers' pockets, the penalties are not very great. And so they don't really deter, it seems, a lot of this bad behavior, because even if, you know, there's a settlement, as there has been several in New York State recently with Domino's and McDonald's and the state attorney general's office, even when there's a settlement and they say, okay, we did this, we're fixing things, the penalties don't seem to be so scary and so painful that it's not going that they will discourage a lot of other similarly situated companies from doing the same thing.
So they're mainly fined and ordered to pay back wages, but never criminally prosecuted?
It's not that they're never criminally prosecuted. It's just very rare. For the most part, the laws are structured so that it really encourages civil penalties instead of criminal penalties. But even when the Department of Labor gets involved and they start investigating for a violation of the federal law, they can only impose civil penalties. So there are ways to pursue bad actors when they're stealing workers' wages as criminals and, you know, try to send them to jail. But the ways that are achievable are not often used.
So if you are a worker who believes he or she is a victim of wage theft, where should you go? What should you do? What's your first?
So probably the best place to go would be the Department of Labor, just because, as I said, most states don't have the same kinds of protections, and so you have to go to a federal authority.
Is there any sense as to how much in the aggregate has been lost? How many wages have been lost to this?
That's an excellent question that I don't think anybody knows the answer to, unfortunately. It seems pretty rampant, but putting a dollar figure on it is difficult just because it's so hard to actually, you know, find reliable data.
Catherine Rampell has written about the wage theft issue in today's Washington Post. She is a columnist there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, what it takes to become a life coach. The multi-billion dollar industry is attracting people who've been affected by the recession. That's next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
So a life coach is just like having a really good friend.
I charge on a monthly package basis.
So a life coach is like having a really good friend who charges.
Comedian Dimitri Martin on The Daily Show back in 2006. And back then, life coaches were a pretty easy target. But according to writer Genevieve Smith, the recession changed all that. And now life coaching is a $2 billion industry, and it's become more mainstream. Even a Harvard-affiliated hospital recently launched an institute to support coaching-related research, practice, and education. Genevieve Smith wanted to know more about this phenomenon, and so she decided to actually attend classes for coaches-to-be. Her result is an article called 50,000 Life Coaches Can't Be Wrong, and it's in this month's issue of Harper's Magazine. Genevieve, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, why did you decide to do this article?
I think like everyone else, I would hear occasionally about someone going to a life coach, and it just seemed kind of like a flaky thing that people did with too much money. And then after the recession, I just started hearing of all of these people who are becoming coaches. Everyone I talked to, their cousin, their parent, their brother. And I wanted to learn a little bit more about how it could possibly be an industry and how it was possible if you were going through some sort of career transition yourself. I mean, you're going to classes to change careers, how it was that you thought you could help other people get over the hurdles in their life.
So you chose from a myriad of courses, a particular course. How did you choose the course that you took?
Well, part of it was people who would let me sit in on the course. That had something to do with it. But I wanted to really give it a fair shake. So I wanted to choose a course that was well-regarded, that had as much certification and licensure as you could possibly have. There's one main professional body for coaches. And the school that I went to, the Coaches Training Institute, CTI, they helped actually write the bylaws of the main professional body.
So you take this course, and who are your other fellow aspirants?
Well, the vast majority of them are women with college degrees in their, you know, 40s and 50s, mostly white. But in terms of who those people actually are, there's a lot more variety there. There are people who've had professional careers in the corporate sector, mothers who were transitioning back into the workforce. There were therapists who realized that adding life coaching as a credential to their resume helped them broaden their client base and bring in people who weren't just, you know, the sickest of the sick, but people who felt like, I just need a little bit more out of my life. You know, for the most part, everyone there really saw this as a way of trying to have a career where they could really do some good and help people.
And then what kinds of things did you learn? What was the course like?
Oh, so the course, so I should say that I found out after the fact that there's sort of a spectrum in life coaching. Some is very much geared toward, you know, the corporate client. It's very sort of goal-oriented. And then there's some that's much closer to therapy that really does kind of seem to blur the line and gets into a lot of emotional muckety-muck kind of stuff. And CTI definitely leans toward the emotional stuff. And what we learned how to do in the course was how to listen very actively, how to—we learned a lot of tools that might be familiar to people who've done cognitive behavioral therapy kinds of psychotherapy that help people kind of break out of patterns. So how do you see a problem from a different perspective? How do you process something really difficult that's happened? How do you really listen to a person? So I was actually surprised to know that there were some skills involved in this. I mean, it wasn't just, you know, there were really things that you could teach someone how to be better at listening and helping somebody and not having your own agenda for a person.
Well, now you've put your finger on the issue that I think most people have with life coaches and what was alluded to at the top of this piece with that bit by Dimitri Martin, and that is, what is the difference between being a really good friend, a good listener, and being a life coach?
Well, what they would say is that, you know, you need somebody who's impartial, who doesn't have an agenda for you, that it's very hard for your friends to divorce their own agendas for you and their own desires for you. And, you know, the same way that people go to therapists in part because they need to have a space where they can explore these things, where the person is there completely dedicated to helping them through whatever it is that they're doing.
I mean, but the thing with therapy, though, is you assume that there is some kind of professional expertise behind the opinions and the advice that your therapist might give you.
Right. Well, yeah, absolutely. And what they would say is that the thing that they're giving you doesn't actually require any professionalized, specialized knowledge in that way.
So what's your conclusion then? Do you think that people who are, you know, in transition themselves, searching for something themselves, a bit lost themselves, can be effective life coaches?
That's a great question. I think that you can get better. I think most people came out better at it than when they started. And I do think that they probably made a lot of progress on healing themselves through the course. You know, I don't know how much of it is innate skill and how much of it is something that can be really taught. I mean, certainly you can have some tricks, but those tricks aren't necessarily going to make you very good at it.
What about earning a living as a life coach? Can you do that?
Well, that's, I think, even a much greater challenge. One thing that seemed pretty clear to me is, you know, they're producing all of these coaches. And the main question that would come up, the course was broken down into 5 3-day modules. And every single module, the question that came up over and over again was, how do I make this into a business? How do I get clients? What do I charge? And people were really anxious. And obviously, so, you know, they're putting forward all this money, they're in a career transition, they want to be able to recoup some of that and to make it into a living. And I think these programs are really, really good at producing coaches. I don't think they're producing necessarily great coach businesses. And I do think it's probably pretty challenging to build a business doing this.
But maybe not so challenging building a business teaching coaches.
Absolutely. I mean, that was the thing that really struck me. And if you talk to the teachers in a lot of these places, and these are the people, so they, most of them had taken done their training through CTI, and then they're hand chosen to be the trainers for this. And you get the sense that they're making their money mainly through teaching these courses and through working with corporations and working with corporate clients, which to me was especially ironic for the people who really did this in order to flee the corporate sector, that the real money in it was the fact that this has kind of become a new sort of HR product for big corporations, where they bring in these motivational people to help their sort of fragile workforce feel motivated and feel goal-oriented, and sort of the things that used to kind of fall on sort of the middle management, which doesn't really exist as much anymore. Now that goes to the coaches.
Have you decided to try this, become a coach after your course?
I am pretty happy with my career. it's really fun when you feel like you are successful at it. But what you realize is that epiphany moment in a conversation with someone is actually pretty cheap. It's pretty easy to get somebody to the point of like, oh, I've just found out this thing about my life. You know, there's tons of tears throughout the course. And you realize, like, if people are primed for it, if people want to have a transformative experience, they're going to have one. And so there was a satisfaction in that, right? And feeling mm-hmm. like, oh, you know, look, I just changed somebody's life. But I think it's pretty fleeting. And I think that real change is a lot harder and probably pretty imperceptible. So I think I'm happy just observing from the outside.
Genevieve Smith's article on life coaches is in the current issue of Harper's Magazine. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Coming up, Johnny Depp plays a talking computer, in a way, in a new movie that tries to be as interesting as the movie Her. We'll find out what our film critics think of Transcendence and other new movies after this news update with KCRW's Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Time for the new releases in Hollywood and some business stories because it's Friday and it's time for our film segment. Today we're joined by Kyle Buchanan, senior editor at New York Magazine. Hi.
Hi.
And Christy Lemire, film critic and co-host of What the Flick.
Hello.
Hi. All right. So the big movie this week is Transcendence, starring Johnny Depp. And let's hear a little clip from it.
Well, are you surprised to see me, Joseph?
That depends.
On what?
Can you prove you're self-aware?
That's Morgan Freeman, I guess. And that voice, that disembodied voice, is Johnny Depp?
It is. And it's not a movie that necessarily plays to his strengths. When you think of Johnny Depp, you think costumes, you think...
eyeliner.
Yeah, you think of this actor who loves to disappear into a role and have all these crazy mannerisms. This is a movie where, since he's playing an artificial intelligence, he's a face staring straight forward, speaking in a monotone on a monitor for almost all of the movie's running time. That is not necessarily the best use of Johnny Depp.
Right. What is this movie about?
So this is the directing debut of Wally Pfister, who was Christopher Nolan's longtime cinematographer. And it's about Johnny Depp plays this brilliant professor who's been experimenting with artificial intelligence. A high-tech terrorist group shoots him down, and so he uploads himself to the internet to preserve his legacy. But he begins to play God and, like, infiltrates every machine possible in everyone's brain. And it has these really thinky ideas about the power of technology and the possibilities for good, but also the threat to privacy and the possibility of authoritarianism. Big ideas.
This sounds really interesting,
it does,
actually.
Doesn't it? But it gets boring and silly.
It thinks it's thinky, and that's the problem. Oh. It's a lot of very smart people in the service of a very dunderheaded movie.
It's cool looking. I mean, Wally Pfister has, you know, great, beautiful, striking visual images here, but Rebecca Hall is good in this.
Yeah, she's always great. She plays Johnny Depp's love interest, and she's the one who sort of takes control of this project to upload him and then realizes, oh, what have I done? He's turning
created
into sort of a crazy
Frankenstein's
computer.
Monster kind of
thing. Yeah, yeah. HAL 9000 on the internet.
Right. And so it's like Her gone negative and male.
But the thing with Her that was so great is that there was a great humanity to the machine and man interface.
Right.
Here there is this disconnect and there is a fear that they tried to play on, and it just ends up being kind of unintentionally hilarious because everywhere Rebecca Hall goes, like, there's Johnny Depp on a flat screen going, Evelyn, what's wrong? Why won't you talk to me? And it's like, go away, weird stalker.
When you're dealing with these really
and
futuristic...
And that's her husband?
Yeah, go cure cancer. Quit bothering me.
These really futuristic movies, I think, need a sense of humor. You know, when you have something that's as self-serious as Transcendence, all of those moments that sort of, you know, skirt the edge of absurd, people start giggling in their seats. And that's what Her had in spades. You know, there were all these moments where, you know, nudge at the fact, and the characters realized, isn't it kind of silly for me to be falling in love with this AI? And when they would say that, it would puncture the balloon. You would breathe a little bit. You would say, I was thinking that too. And it would allow you to get a little bit closer to what the movie's talking about.
Okay, speaking of maybe unintentionally humorous, Fading Gigolo. This is a movie starring John Turturro, and he actually also writes it and directs in it. It's his baby. And here he is with Sofia Vergara.
Do you have any idea what goes on inside a woman's head?
If I did, I wouldn't be here.
Funny. You're funny. I like that. A woman is meant to be looked at. Or else she'll just fade away.
Okay. And Kyle?
So yeah, this movie, Totoro casts himself as a man who's sort of pressed into service by his friend Woody Allen, who's cash-strapped, and knows of a woman, played by Sharon Stone in this, who's looking for somebody who can sort of satisfy her needs. And so Woody Allen becomes the pimp, Totoro becomes the gigolo, and after Sharon Stone leaves satisfied, she recommends Totoro to her friend Sofia Vergara. Which, yeah, I can
it's
see.
It's a little unbelievable. Yeah,
I think the radio audience can't see your facial expressions, Madeline, but they can maybe sense them by the tone in your voice. It's completely unbelievable. The whole thing is a fantasy. I have to say it actually
a male
sort of
fantasy.
Oh, for sure, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
It does kind of hang together once you see it because the movie is fairly gentle about it. Mm. It has this sort of like, it takes place in this magic world where none of this could possibly happen. And I think that when you isolate a clip out of context, that, you know, that illusion is definitely is definitely punctured. But it works. And even though he's cast these beautiful screen sirens as his love interests that are insatiable and can't get enough of him, it's almost part of the cartoon. And maybe
does he make fun of that at all?
Yeah, he does. Okay. You know, he's not selling himself as like the stud to end all studs. It's even there in the title that this is not the sort of person that you'd expect to be pulling in these beautiful women. But it works. It works somehow. And I think maybe the presence of Woody Allen in this movie, in one of his rare roles where he's acting and not directing, almost legitimizes that because Allen himself has cast himself countless times.
Opposite beautiful women.
Who can't get enough of him.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. I have to say, like, I don't know if this is the best time in the marketplace to be releasing a Woody Allen sex comedy. But honestly, it's actually sort of surprising how minimal that potentially torpedoing element factors into this movie.
But you have to look at it out of context.
Yeah, you have to be willing to buy in
and
essentially.
Suspend and all then, your disbelief.
Yes.
And forget everything that's happened in the real world.
I have a feeling you might not be
people.
Able to. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, moving on to a horror film, 13 Sins, and this is where a down on his luck man gets a phone call that will change his life.
Hello?
Congratulations. You have been selected to take part in a one of a kind game show. All you have to do is complete 13 challenges.
13 challenges. Christy, this yes. is a remake of a Thai movie, right?
A 2006 Thai film called 13 Beloved. Mark Webber plays this very milquetoast salesman who in one day loses his job. He's about to get married. His girlfriend's pregnant. He's drowning in debt. The phone call gives him the chance to win up to $6.2 million. All he has to do is complete these tasks. And at first, they seem rather innocuous. And then they get increasingly challenging and grisly and horrific. And it's darkly funny and very twisted, but also kind of plays to our sense of the need to get rich quick and our impatience of wanting to make things right immediately. And I liked it a lot. It's really funny in a very twisted way.
So it's also like playing on our ideas of reality shows and watching people engage in increasingly horrific competitive acts for money.
Right. And it makes you wonder, well, would you do that as well? And part of why it works is that Mark Webber is such a sympathetic figure and you watch him come into his own as he's doing these horrific acts and you kind of find yourself inadvertently rooting for him to get away with it because he's finally found himself and find his confidence. So I enjoyed it.
13 Sins. Okay, let's turn to the new side of Hollywood, and Cannes is next month, right,
it
Kyle?
It is in May, yeah.
And so the lineup was released, and what do you think?
There's some really intriguing titles there. We have Foxcatcher, which was supposed to come out at the end of last year and got bumped. It's directed by Bennett Miller, who directed two other Best Picture nominees, Capote and Moneyball. And it has Steve Carell in a very weird, different, dark role, and Channing Tatum and Mark Ruffalo. And then there's also The Homesman, Tommy Lee Jones's next picture. He directed that. It's got Meryl Streep and Hailee Steinfeld. The one I'm definitely most interested to see, though, is it's called Lost River, and it's directed by Ryan Gosling in his directorial debut. It has you know, a lot of good people in it, Christina Hendricks, Saoirse Ronan, Eva Mendes. And I'm just kind of curious what his sensibility is going to be.
Yeah.
I have this idea that it's going to be kind of Nicholas Winding Refn-esque in that he's worked with him so much.
Right,
I wonder if it'll be kind of languid like that.
Yeah, the director of Drive, Gosling, has sort of been his muse, and you would think, especially because Refn is such a strong personality, that he might have learned something from them. But Gosling's worked with a lot of great people, so it'll be interesting to see. And what's also interesting about that Cannes lineup is what didn't make it in, or what movies were heavily courted to be part of the Cannes lineup and refused. You know, we didn't see the new Paul Thomas Anderson movie, Inherent Vice, which everyone is looking forward to. That's not part of the lineup. There are a couple others, like the new Terrence Malick, the new Alejandro González Iñárritu, that weren't there. And I think part of the problem is studios are leery about a potential Oscar campaign that's going to drag from May, when we have Cannes, to February, when we've got the Oscars. You know, last year, the Oscar winner and runner-up were 12 Years a Slave and presumed to be Gravity. Those debuted in September at Telluride in Toronto. And the ones that came out in May were Nebraska, which did get some nominations but no wins, and Inside Llewyn Davis, which was shut out for all the big ones. I just don't think that, you know, the powers that be wanted to put out those movies.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
So a business decision. And so I guess Cannes is maybe thinking, what's happening here? We should be the big film festival.
It's a business decision and also an artistic one, because these movies are eventually going to come out theatrically at the end of the year. And if you're a director who's very meticulous, like Paul Thomas Anderson, do you want to rush and get it done in May and then sit on your hands until the end of the year? Or do you want to be a little bit more laissez-faire about it and, you know, not have to be in the editing room for 13 hours a day?
Another movie perhaps not premiering ever, definitely not premiering ever, The Hateful Eight, Quentin Tarantino's famously scrapped project. And Chrissy, tell us what happened.
So the script for Hateful Eight got leaked out online, and that happens a lot. I mean, screenplays are out there floating around quite a bit. I never read them. I want to go in cold and be surprised, but I know a lot of folks want to visualize what's going to happen. So Tarantino freaked out. It got posted on Gawker, yes?
Gawker linked to where you could find
right.
it.
Right, yeah. And so he's like, I'm not making this movie now. Instead, he's doing a live reading here in Los Angeles tomorrow night, and which has been done a lot through Film Independent and through the LACMA of movies like American Beauty or Breakfast Club
or Reservoir Dogs.
And The Apartment.
But these are movies that have been made,
right? And so this will first be seen by people reading it on a stage, and I don't blame him, because I don't view that decision to share the script as an artistic one. It's all about page views, and that seems really cruel and thoughtless to sabotage someone's film that way just for page views.
Mm-hmm. But why is it sabotaging rather than giving some advanced publicity?
Because I think it depletes the element of surprise that perhaps he was going for. It's not like he said, oh yeah, sure, please go ahead and share my script with the world. He didn't want it out there. As he put it, I shared it with six expletive people. You know, and it got out.
He's got to look at his inner circle.
Who can he trust, right?
He did. I mean, he put a lot of agents on blast because he'd only sent it to a select few actors. And I think also part of the problem that exacerbated this is that Gawker sort of took the lead in posting this. Gawker is a site that Tarantino has a longstanding beef with. They published a young woman who had sort of an assignation with Tarantino. They published her account of it, which was a pretty humiliating story, and not only published it, but a few years later hired that woman to run Defamer, which is their Hollywood branch. And I think that obviously they are a site that is the target of his ire. So when Gawker posted this, you know, leaked script for The Hateful Eight, that was just a confluence of events that that really got his attention and really upset him.
I don't blame him.
Yeah.
So tomorrow night, if you want, you can go hear him or hear his actors read the script.
Yes, on stage.
And this is at the Ace Hotel.
Interesting.
Right?
And it's a very talky piece anyway. So
shocking. Do you know what it's about?
It's a Western, but it takes place really only in a handful of locations. It's just a whole lot of people talking at each other, very conversational.
Otherwise known as a Quentin Tarantino film.
Yeah, with a little less action than you might even expect.
A little less violence.
Yeah, well, there's still that.
Kyle Buchanan, senior editor for New York Magazine, never committing verbal violence here. And Christy Lemire, film critic and co-host of What the Flick, which you can see on YouTube. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you. Speaking of a whole lot of talking, we got some more coming up at 1 o'clock with Warren Olney.
We do indeed, and we're going to be talking about something that sounds like a Hollywood movie. New surveillance techniques developed in Iraq and Afghanistan, now available to local police, that let them, for example, hover over a city in a small plane for 5 or 6 hours with multiple cameras, high-resolution cameras that can effectively record what's going on for all of that time on video. And the police can then go and look at the video. If a crime occurs, for example, mm-hmm. they can find it on the video. They can zoom in on it. And they have real time in both directions, so they can see how somebody got there and how somebody got away.
Wow.
And it's a way of, obviously, helping to solve
crime.
Why
don't we have that?
Thanks anyway.
All right, Warren Olney, and To the Point, that's coming up at 1 o'clock. And coming up on this program, the SAT says high school students will no longer have to know difficult words like obdurate, ineffable, maelstrom. Why that decision may be an egregious calamity, next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, word aficionados were apoplectic this week after receiving some dispiriting news about the SAT test. In fact, it's now unlikely students will see words like apoplectic or dispiriting on those tests. The College Board announced it's making changes to the vocab section. It's going to abrogate or ditch the highfalutin $5 words for which the SAT is famous. Instead, students will be tested on so-called high utility words, in other words, words that are more common. Joining me now to bemoan these changes is Debbie Steer. She's author of the book, The Perfect Score Project, Uncovering Secrets of the SAT. Hi, Debbie.
Hi, Madeline. That was a very good use of a lot of SAT words.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Well, let's before we get to these vocab changes, let's talk about your experience with the SAT, because you are a mother of two teenagers,
yes,
right?
Yes.
And yet you voluntarily, I guess, took the SAT yourself 7 times.
I did. It was the year before my son, who is now 18, but it was the year before he had to take the SAT himself. And I started looking into it, and I started with the SAT question of the day from the College Board. And I got hooked, and I thought it was fun, like Scrabble or Sudoku or crossword puzzles. And before I knew it, I had a project that had morphed into what was ultimately to become a sort of consumer reports on the SAT and test prep and everything you would need to know.
Wow. Did you enjoy actually taking those tests?
I loved it.
Really?
Part of the reason I did this is because I seem to be one of the few people, I'm not alone, but we're a very small niche of people who enjoy the SAT. And I thought, well, you know, why don't I just, you know, decipher all of this on behalf of the rest of the people who seem to hate it.
And what did you find? Did you have a better appreciation for it?
I do. I found that it is not a test that you can cram for, but if you have a solid foundation, you can improve your score greatly. And so my math score, for all intents and purposes, did not improve, and I would say, it's safe to say, I did not have a solid foundation. I couldn't test prep my way into a better score. Mm-hmm. And my reading and writing scores improved by 330 points, which, you know, the average reading score is 5 to 10 points. That's what the College Board says after test prep. So I had a solid foundation in reading and writing. I was able to improve.
Oh, my gosh. 330 points?
Yeah.
So what's the secret? Reading the dictionary every day?
No, not at all. Reading.
Just reading.
Yeah, just reading and background knowledge and, you know, to the point of the vocabulary, the more, you know, vocabulary is knowledge, and the more you know, the more you can understand. And so I was in book publishing for 23 years. I did a lot of reading, and so I was able to improve.
Okay, so what do you think about these? I'm guessing I know your answer to this, but anyway, I'll ask anyway. What do you think of these new changes that the SAT announced?
You know, you were listing all these words that they are supposedly taking off the SAT, and I haven't actually seen a list of words that they're getting rid of. What I've seen is, you know, we're getting rid of quote-unquote obscure vocabulary, but no one has actually defined what these high-utility words are. And it's also a contradiction with another part of their announcement, which is they're going to be using founding documents, such as the Declaration of Independence. So guess what? The founding documents are laden with SAT words. So I'm going to say I think, you know, getting rid of obscure words is a terrible idea, but I'm hopeful that it's semantics, that it's rebranding, and that the truth of the matter is that, you know, the words that they're going to be testing are the words that kids are using in school in, you know, Shakespeare and 1984. So I'm hoping it's more rebranding than reality, because to get rid of vocabulary is a terrible idea.
Yeah, I don't know if that's necessarily the case in terms of the rebranding. I think that they actually have a pretty solid argument in that they think, well, we want to make this test relevant, and mm-hmm. we want to make sure that kids are prepared for what they're going to face. And maybe having these obscure words is not something that they should be prepared for, because they're never going to use them anyway.
Well, I guess it's a question of what's obscure, because the words that they're testing, I don't think you or I or most educated adults would consider to be obscure. I mean, if you look at the New York Times, any article has quote-unquote obscure words. And the irony is when these journalists are writing these stories, they're using galvanizing and thwarting and winnowing, and those are words that are tested that are...
Lugubrious.
Lugubrious.
That's a good one.
I love lugubrious.
Well, what are some of your favorite SAT words?
I think my favorites are pernicious. I love, you know, a lot of these words I have known, but I like to bring them back into rotation and be reminded of them. Opprobrium, I love that. Phlegmatic. Opprobrium, by the way, means harsh criticism. And I remember at the time I heard there was arguments over fields in the town, and I remember thinking to myself, the fields are being met with opprobrium by the people in the town. Anyway, phlegmatic is sort of phlegmy. I like to think mm-hmm. of it like Alfred Hitchcock's voice. What are some? Oh, archipelago. The kids seem to know that one, but
that's
I love
one.
That. Mawkish. That was actually one they tripped me up with on the SAT. I only didn't know a few words.
Does that mean sentimental?
It does. It means overly sentimental.
Yeah.
Treacly. It means similar to treacly, which incidentally is a word that they often cite as obscure. And ironically, the kids know that because it's in Harry Potter.
So there are other changes going on with the SAT. The essay part of it is now voluntary. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that, you know, for the most part, as with the ACT, for the top, say, 100 schools, you're still probably going to have to take it. And so, you know, it's probably the least, you know, it's the least objective part of the test. And so if you're not applying to one of the top, you know, 100 schools, fine. So it's fine to have that go.
No, but you did really well on your essay test, I noticed.
Well, you know, I did okay. The truth of the matter is that the top score you can get is a 12, and it's based on two graders, and I was never able to get higher than a 10. And in fact, my son, who is not, he's considered a math kid and really had no interest in writing or the SAT, he got an 11. And my friend Catherine Johnson, who wrote the book Animals in Translation, and her books are used in the reading section, she took the SAT also one time. She got a 10 on the essay. So, you know, when I say that it's the least objective, and, you know, they've done all sorts of studies where they give essays, not even SAT essays, but just essays in general to 10 different people, and you get 10 different grades, so...
You know, a lot of parents, or there's a growing number of parents who are saying, forget it. The SAT is flawed. It doesn't really predict college achievement. And I don't want to put my kid through that. So I'm not going to participate. What
right,
do you think of that?
Right. Well, you know, so what is the alternative? I mean, the alternative is, you know, essays, which, as we just discussed, you give them to 10 different people and they're going to have 10 different, you're going to have 10 different grades. It's fuzzier. I mean, believe me, I was a kid who didn't do well on the SAT in high school, and I was glad there were SAT optional schools at the time. However, I don't see a better alternative. It's one point of data. If you happen to have all other great points of data, great. The other thing that people don't realize is that it is used as a variable for merit aid, which is free money when you go to college. So even if at these optional schools and these parents who are willing to forego it, you know, pull their kid out of the, running,
throwing away
giving
money.
Up free money.
Debbie Steer, author of the book The Perfect Score Project, Uncovering the Secrets of the SAT. Thank you very much.
Madeline, thank you for having me.
My pleasure. And it is my pleasure to welcome the never mawkish, always ineffable,
only mawkish within the comfort of my own home. I would never let you people see that.
Slightly pernicious, Jolie Myers.
Slightly? So at the top of the show, we asked whether you thought parking tickets were out of control in Los Angeles, and you all were positively acerbic in your responses
nice.
On Facebook. Obstreperous, even. Eric Craig says he is so sick of being nickeled and dimed every time he leaves the house by the overabundance of meters in Los Angeles. He points out that many of the meters are 1 hour only and that you can't even get a haircut in an hour in Los Angeles. It's we're set up to fail here. Carrie Saxon shared her Kafka-esque parking ticket story. She says, I work in Westwood and usually take the bus, but one day I drove and parked on the street. I got a ticket for going over the 2 hour limit, even though I wasn't even at the spot when they said I was. Fortunately, I had a car wash receipt that proved I wasn't there, so I was able to contest my ticket. But I had to pay the fine before I could schedule a hearing. The fee for the paying online was non-refundable. I had to miss an entire day of work for the hearing, and it took forever to get the refund for my bogus ticket. Poor Carrie. But Richard Saavedra says, go Metro. Problem solved. My New Year's resolution this year was to not get a parking ticket, and it's kind of taken over my life. Like, I would totally skip somebody's birthday party if it meant that I might get a parking ticket. But so far, so good.
All right. Jolie Myers, parking safely for the first 4 months of the year, at least. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Have a great weekend, hopefully free of parking tickets. And Warren Olney, and To the Point, up next. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great weekend, everyone. I'll see you on Monday.